Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's the great thing about the stock market. You never know what's going to happen. You wake up and maybe inflation's tame, so you think, hey, today could be a pretty good day. Or corporate profits are up, so investors will be in a buying mood. Of course, it's wise to remember Wall Street works the other way, too, on days like today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here. Today's Tuesday. It's the 24th of July. And in all honesty, it's tough to figure out where to start. Maybe yesterday after the closing bell would be a good place. And an earnings report from Texas Instruments. It's the world's biggest maker of computer chips for cell phones. And TI said yesterday the outlook for the coming quarter is grim at best. Then this morning it was DuPont, where profits didn't quite live up to expectations. I could go on with a whole roster of others, though there were some bright spots, defense stocks and drug makers, and airlines. United and JetBlue led the way with higher profits, but you could fairly say airlines are becoming victims of their recent success. A lot of people are coping with canceled flights this summer because of something the Federal Aviation Administration calls overscheduling. The airlines blame an overstretched air traffic control system, but that may still not explain a spike in cancellations at Northwest Airlines, due in large part to not having enough people to fly the planes. From Minnesota Public Radio, Martin Moylan reports.
On a typical day, an airline may cancel 1 or 2% of its flights. But on Sunday, Northwest says it canceled about 4%, or around 75 flights. On Monday, it scrubbed about 60. Today, Northwest says cancellations are back to normal, with about 2% of flights going nowhere. Northwest blames the recent uptick in cancellations on mechanical problems, bad weather, air traffic control snarl-ups, and what it calls crew-related issues. Late last month, Northwest recalled about 400 laid-off pilots, but it takes time to get pilots retrained. Pilot union spokesman Monty Montgomery says the airline still isn't prepared to fly all its scheduled flights.
That is due to pilot staffing. We are insufficiently staffed to fly the schedule as posted.
The pilot's contract calls for them to fly up to 90 hours a month. They could fly more under federal rules, but the union says few do because they're too worn out. Travel expert Terry Tripler blames Northwest for the jump in cancellations.
When a pilot says he or she is too fatigued to fly, end of story. And so if they say they are too fatigued to fly, if they have hit their 90 hours, who's to blame? Obviously management.
Northwest would not offer a forecast for flight cancellations for the rest of the month, but the pilots' union expects they could be above normal. In St. Paul, I'm Martin Moylan for Marketplace.
There's news from Europe today of an unusual trade deal. The headlines mention something about Bulgarian medical workers being released after 8 years in a Libyan jail. And there were vague references to closer cooperation between the European Union and Muammar Gaddafi in return for the clemency. So we've got Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the line from London for more on this story. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
Let's get straight to it then. Did any actual cash change hands for this release?
We know that money played a part, but it's not entirely clear whose money it was. You may recall that the medic's death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment last week, and that was as a result of $1 million in compensation being paid to each of the 438 families involved. Now, Libyan sources say that the EU and France in particular made a contribution to that. Both the EU and France deny it. There have been other suggestions, though, that Bulgaria and other former communist states in Eastern Europe forgave some of Libya's foreign debt. But whatever the truth of the matter, we can be sure that economics is certainly a key feature of this story. Libya and Europe hope to benefit economically from this deal.
Define your terms for me, Stephen. How do they hope to benefit economically then?
Europe wants a big slice of the contracts to modernize and build up Libya and its oil industry, while the Libyans want greater access to the European market for Libyan exports, which are primarily oil and gas, but also agricultural produce and other raw materials. And Libya wants and needs a lot of foreign investment and technical help to upgrade its oil industry, which, you know, clearly after all these years of isolation is in a pretty poor state.
Is there a dollar amount here, Stephen, that you can put on this arrangement?
It's difficult to put a precise figure on it. I mean, we're talking about oil and gas, two very valuable commodities today. I mean, at the moment, Libya is pumping about 1.5 million barrels a day, which hardly puts it in the Saudi Arabian league. But the country is sitting on oil reserves, proven oil reserves, of at least 30 billion barrels. And analysts say that with modern technology, they could uncover very much greater quantities. Now, Libya, in terms of hard figures, is talking about attracting about $30 billion worth of foreign investment over the next few years in order to double its capacity to about 3 million barrels a day.
Let's play the geopolitical card here for just a second. Obviously, the Europeans want in on the Libyan market. What about the United States and oil companies here? Who's better positioned to take advantage of this deal?
The U.S., in terms of developing the oil and energy resources because of their technological lead, but European companies are in there too, and the Libyans are very interested in forging closer political and economic links with Europe because Europe is right on their doorstep. A clear sign of the competition to come, though, comes with President Sarkozy of France, whose wife assisted in today's release, announcing that he's going to Libya tomorrow, in his words, to help Libya rejoin the international community. Well, knowing the self-interest of the French, we can be pretty sure he'll come home with a contract or two in his back pocket.
Stephen Beard at the Marketplace European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
It's always nice to come home to a clean house, no matter where you've been. But a report out today suggests clean might actually be hazardous to your health. Only there's no way to find out for sure. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer explains.
You probably haven't heard of most of these chemicals, and they're certainly hard to pronounce.
Monoethanolamine. This is a chemical that's known to be an inducer of occupational asthma. It's found in lots of common laundry detergents. You also find solvents like 2-butoxyethanol.
Alexandra Gorman says you find that in general surface cleaners. Gorman wrote this report, Household Hazards, for the environmental group Women's Voices for the Earth. She says over 75 different studies link chemicals ubiquitous in cleaning products to health problems. So she asked 23 major manufacturers to list the ingredients, but got no response from most of them. Those that did reply said their formulas were trade secrets. Procter & Gamble's Ross Holthouse says there are several reasons they don't list ingredients. For a start, the law doesn't require it.
Those chemical names are fairly lengthy, and for the consumer, a common chemical name can be somewhat frightening.
And there could be 200 or 300 different components in any product. There'd be no space. But Holthouse says consumer safety is their highest priority. If they hear enough public complaints, they could change their policy. Meanwhile, some say the lack of regulation here is a public danger. Richard Wiles of the Environmental Working Group.
You don't get to know what's in the product, and there's no government assessment of the safety of the product.
Wiles says legislation due this fall could demand that chemicals are shown to be safe before they're put on the market. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Investors rounded up the usual suspects today as the major indices each dropped more than 1.5%. We will have the details when we do the numbers. While the Bancroft family considers its options for the Wall Street Journal, the rest of the newspaper business keeps on limping along. And it has been a tumultuous couple of years. Knight Ridder was the second largest newspaper publisher in this country until it sold itself off. The fate of the Los Angeles Times was up in the air until just recently, and even now it's fighting losses and cutting staff. The same is true at the San Francisco Chronicle. Commentator and journalism professor Neil Henry says he thinks he knows what's happened.
I had no idea the job cuts at the San Francisco Chronicle would be this sudden, this deep, this personal. Some of my former students facing unemployment. We know what happened. Marvelous search engines like Google, with magical new powers to spread news and information. Along the way, they've profited enormously. But for a host of reasons, the actual producers of the web's news content, the reporters and editors, get very little benefit from this technological marvel. And so we live in a world of paradox, don't we? Internet companies provide news every day, free of charge, no less. Yet highly skilled people doing the expensive work of digging, finding, and reporting the very best of it are endangered. It's hard for me not to wonder if corporations like Google feel any tug of civic responsibility. After all, their breathtaking success as news aggregators has sprung indirectly from the fruit of professional journalism. From Andrew Carnegie on down, rich philanthropists who rose from rags have sought ways to give back to America by investing in civic endeavors vital to a healthy democracy. Few things to me are more vital than journalism practiced according to high standards. Simply put, Google could do much more to protect this public trust, offer support to journalism education and professional groups dedicated to truth-seeking and time-honored ethical values, and assist newspapers directly, just as I think it's time for newspapers to band together to sue to protect content. We are experiencing a tragedy that transcends dollars, cents, and jobs lost. The truth is this. If newspapers keep bleeding and dying, one day soon we may find on Google News no news at all. Instead, we'll get fake news from government officials, biased rants from basement bloggers, and PR disguised as journalism by clever advertisers seeking only to sell us more stuff.
Neil Henry is a professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. You can drop us a line with your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. There's been record flooding in Europe and China this week, but in many other parts of the world, the news is of drought and a shortage of potable water. More than a billion people worldwide don't have access to drinking water, but in South Africa, pumping for water has taken on a whole new meaning. Gretchen Wilson reports now from the village of Boikarabelo.
It doesn't sound like it, but these kids are hard at work. This is a cool invention. It's a play pump, a merry-go-round like a playground toy. As kids spin it around, they draw gallons of pure water from an underground well and into an elevated storage tank. It all flows to a free tap for this community of 1,000 people. And this isn't run-of-the-mill water either. Khan Kluti runs the development projects in the village.
Yeah, apparently when they tested the water, it was superior even to Perrier.
But mostly it's used for cooking and washing. In Africa's rural areas, piped water systems are still a rarity. Streams and other water sources can run low or be polluted by a cow that happened to die in the wrong place. That's why a small, cheap solution can make a big difference. Each costs $14,000. So far, there are about 1,000 play pumps in 4 African countries, serving more than 1 million people.
They can now collect water when and where they feel like. And they don't have to walk that far because the play pump is situated right in the middle of the village.
Village chair Alison Gwenya takes me on a gravel road to the far edge of Boikarabelo. Most villagers used to walk a half a mile here and back again, hauling about 40 pounds of water on their head or shoulders.
We used to use this tap. This tap was supplying the school and was also supplying the village. So you can see that now it's broken. Can you imagine from there coming here? And some of these people, they are old, some they are sick. They have to walk a very long distance.
And that's a relatively short order. Women and children in rural Africa walk an average of 5 miles a day for water. Play Pump's backers include the U.S. government, the Case Foundation, and private donors. If the funding keeps flowing, 4,000 communities will have similar pumps by 2010. A local subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson installed this one 3 years ago. 62-year-old Lady Mnisi is in her yard doing laundry hunched over a tin wash bin.
Before this pump, it was tough because there was a big line and we used to stand long hours. Now at least I'm able to wash and bathe my granddaughter.
The play pumps also become a wellspring for emerging businesses. Lima Kumbe sells chickens to local supermarkets. Now instead of standing in line, he uses his time to clean cages. This means healthier chickens, which fetch better prices, so he can buy more chickens. 500 chicks run around this coop's dirt floor.
The pump helps me a lot because these chickens need about 75 gallons of water a day. Now I'm trying to raise funds to get a pipe that can come here directly.
Of course, it takes money to maintain the pumps. Companies like Unilever and Vodacom pay big bucks for billboards that surround the tank. Just under these billboards, children come to play on the merry-go-round every day after school. It's created a kind of town center. But the oldest kids have figured this out, and they know it's not just about fun. Again, Konkluti.
Some of them, however, have gotten onto the idea that there is sort of a hidden agenda, but it's not too serious a problem.
Luckily, adults can spin it too. So if the kids ever tucker out, parents can step in. In Boy Carabello, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, the go-getters in your office may be getting less than they bargained for.
They've worked very hard, they have high-paying jobs, and they're utterly miserable.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a veritable nightmare on Wall Street today, and investors pretty much pulled the covers over their heads. The Dow Industrial slashed off 226 points, 1 2/3% to end the day at 13,716. The Nasdaq gushed down 50 points, 1.9% to finish at 2639. The S&P 500 hacked down 30 points, nearly 2% to close at 1511. It was out of the frying pan and into the fire for subprime mortgage lenders. Industry giant Countrywide Financial saw quarterly profits go up in smoke because of the softening housing market. Shares there burned off nearly 10.5%. Wait till you hear this. Rival accredited home lenders crashed 15%. It was a William Tell kind of day for Apple. Turns out iPhone sales actually started out pretty far off the mark, about a fifth of what was expected. Apple shares shot down more than 6%. iPhone service provider AT&T took the hit too. Mobile shares rang down 1.25%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Marketplace date book for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book survey of regional economic conditions. The National Association of Realtors reports on existing home sales for June. And happy birthday to Louise Brown, the world's first test tube baby. She'll be 29. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It is letters time again, and first up this week, a response to our interview with Matt Weiner. He's the creator and executive producer of the new television series Mad Men about the advertising industry circa 1960. Michael Dolan's a journalist and the author of the book The American Porch.
All due respect to Matt Weiner, when he described in last week's broadcast how advertising was changed by the entry into that business of ethnics, Jews, Italians, he left out the most important and defiantly ethnic advertising man in history, George Lois, the in-your-face son of Greek immigrants and progenitor of the Think Small campaign for Volkswagen that Mr. Weiner correctly cites for its epoch-making influence.
I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with John Pike of the website globalsecurity.org. We talked about the future of robotics and warfare, a conversation that made quite a few listeners, like Ben Gross here, uneasy.
I'm not a Luddite. I'd be lost without my computer and could not conceive surviving summer without air conditioning in my office, home, and car. But do we really need to develop Terminators and Robocops that, in Pike's words, will kill without pity and without compunction? What moral and ethical line has our society already crossed if we seek to eliminate the last bits of humanity from the conduct of war?
Big food and beverage makers took the hint last week and came up with some new rules for how they'll market to kids, with television ads specifically. Allison Dainty of Long Beach, California, wrote to highlight something she felt our story glossed over.
If people are pointing to Cap'n Crunch and saying he's the reason their child is obese, then this country has more problems than I thought. I didn't realize this new generation of breadwinners is under the age of 12 and that it's their responsibility to purchase groceries. Where are the parents here?
Hannah Nordgren's a fashion designer here in Los Angeles who does a lot of business with Chinese vendors. She says she can relate to Scott Tong's experiences setting up shop somewhere else.
The golden rule of working with overseas vendors, I found, is assume nothing. Dot all your I's and cross all your T's.
And one last thing. Last week we mentioned a story about Nestle, and we suggested Kit Kat bars are their product. We got some corrections on that, so we double-checked it. Hershey's does distribute Kit Kat here in the U.S., but it's licensed from Nestle's. If you have comments or corrections, our website's the place for you. It's marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. Boy, there is nothing better than summertime to make you want to forget about the 40-hour work week or the 50 or 60-hour week, depending on what kind of job you have. But what if you could get by working less, 90% less? Cash Peters recently picked up a book that says people can prosper that way, and he figured he just had to talk to the guy who wrote it.
I wrote this for the half dozen friends of mine who have done everything right. They have high-paying jobs, and they're utterly miserable. Or, perhaps even worse still, they're bored and they've accepted something that's tolerably mediocre.
We call it working in radio. And Tim Ferriss used to be like that too. Then he developed this system for getting rich without actually doing very much, called the 4-hour work week. It's easy, says him. First, it's vital you eliminate the static of your everyday life, the stuff you don't really need. Stop reading newspapers, for instance. Switch off your radio. And only check your email. Don't switch it off yet. Wait till I've finished. He also suggests you only check your emails twice a day. Plus, start hiring people to do stuff you don't like doing.
If you're spending your hard-earned weekend cleaning your house, go get a cleaning lady who will do a better job for $15 an hour.
Yeah, stuff like that. In other words, start figuring out what your time is really worth. Example.
If you make $50,000 a year and you work 40 hours a week, you get 2 weeks of vacation. All you need to do is you take off the last three zeros, you have 50, you divide that in half, you make $25 an hour.
Yeah. But the point, I have no idea what that means, but the point is you calculate how much you'd have to earn to be living the perfect life. Then, instead of earning it yourself, and this is where it gets brilliant, hire someone to do that for you too.
There is a delegation part. To be the person that you want to be, to have the lifestyle that you want to have, you need to learn to manage other people.
Good morning, Cash Peters' office.
It's okay. I don't really have an office. I just have a woman who says I do. That's Marilyn Hallett of Michigan Avenue Office Services in Chicago. She's my virtual assistant. Tim calls this personal outsourcing. Your assistant can be anywhere in the world. Doesn't matter. They're virtual. But you pay him or her to do your work for you. Trouble is, how do you know you can trust them?
Good morning, Cash Peters' office.
Hey, it's me. How do I know I can trust you, Marilyn?
I think the only thing I can say is you take it one step at a time and wait till you're comfortable before you start divulging too much information to anyone.
There are really only two people could have written this book. You and Santa Claus. Because I'm just thinking this is what Santa's done.
That's true. I mean, he has elves in the North Pole. I have elves in Manila and Bangalore and
But do
Canada.
You really, though? I mean, do you have, like, thousands of people striving away in sweatshops all around the world, keeping your entire lifestyle afloat?
No, I don't have anyone in sweatshops. In fact, some of the virtual assistants that I use are Americans overseas.
Sounds great. And you only pay them hourly, too, which means it's cost-effective. But, well, also kind of impersonal. Having an assistant you don't get to meet every day. Donna Kozik runs MyBigBusinessCard.com, and I was going to ask her about her virtual assistant. Then I thought, no, Marilyn, I'm paying you. You ask her.
Isn't it kind of impersonal having someone you don't get to meet every day? Wouldn't you rather have someone you can gossip with and who'll bring you coffee?
Talking about the latest celebrity in and out of jail doesn't interest me a whole lot. I need someone who can help me make money.
So right now, as we're sitting here and we're both doing nothing, nothing. How many people have you got working for you?
About 325, probably.
325 virtual assistants, all making him money while he just supervises them. The details are in the book, but the last thing Tim says in 4-Hour Workweek is stop thinking about retirement. Get that word right out of your head. In fact, play your cards right, follow his system, and you could retire straight after college.
There are a number of words that are so overused as to have become meaningless, I think.
Cholesterol.
Happiness is another one that I'm not a big fan of. It's a very dangerous term.
And goodbye.
And goodbye. Right. Yeah. I think success is another one. So forget about retirement for the time being. Ask yourself, if I retire today, how am I going to fill that void? What am I going to do?
Better still, hire someone at $40 an hour to fill the void for you. That's what I did.
In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters from Marketplace.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to update you on a story we covered yesterday. We mentioned the DVD rental company Netflix had announced plans to reduce its online rental fees. It's trying to cope with a drop in subscriptions, but sometimes the best of intentions go unrewarded. Just as software engineers were updating those prices last night, the company went offline. The website's been down all day, as were Netflix shares, off almost 7% at the close. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow fell 226 points, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ down 50 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 slid down 30 points. That is 2%. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, an entrepreneur pairs need with new souls.
I saw lots of children who did not have shoes, and I saw the negative health effects of that. You know, they had blisters, and there were cuts, and they were swollen.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.